I'm going to be reading out of Mark chapter 15, verse 21. You can just keep your eyes closed as I read. Here's what I want you to do. One of the great ways to read Scripture is to kind of imagine which character you'd be in the story. And so as I read the final minutes of Jesus' life, the final hours that lead up to this crucifixion, maybe you just want to kind of reflect as each of the characters kind of gets introduced. Who would you be in the story? And sometimes as we recognize who we are, that God speaks most clearly to us. So listen to the word of God from Mark's Gospel, chapter 15, verse 21. So we just ended off in verse 20. They'd mocked him, they stripped him, and then they led him out to crucify him. And then they compelled a passerby, Simon of Cyrene, who was coming in from the country, the father of Alexander and Rufus, to carry his cross. And they brought him to the place called Golgotha, which means the place of a skull. And they offered him wine mixed with myrrh, but he did not take it. And they crucified him and divided his garments among them, casting lots for them to decide what each should take. And it was the third hour when they crucified him, and the inscription of the charge against him read, "The King of the Jews." And with him they crucified two robbers, one on his right and one on his left. And those who passed by derided him, wagging their heads and saying, "Aha, you who would destroy the temple and rebuild it in 3 days, save yourself and come down from the cross." So also the chief priests and the scribes mocked him to one another, saying, "He saved others, but he can't even save himself. Let the Christ, the King of Israel, come down now from the cross that we might see and believe." And those who were crucified with him also reviled him. And when the sixth hour had come, there was darkness over the whole land until the ninth hour. And at the ninth hour, Jesus cried out with a loud voice, "Eloi, Eloi, lama sabachthani," which means, my God, why have you forsaken me?" And some of the bystanders, hearing it, said, "Behold, he's calling Elijah." And so someone ran and filled a sponge with sour wine, put it on a reed and gave it to him to drink, saying, "Wait, let us see whether Elijah will come down and take him down." And then Jesus uttered a loud cry and breathed his last. And the curtain of the temple was torn in two from the top to the bottom. And when the centurion who stood facing him saw that in this way Jesus breathed his last, he said, "Truly, this man was the Son of God." And there were also some women looking on from a distance, among whom were Mary Magdalene and Mary, the mother of James, the younger, and of Joseph, and Salome. And when he was in Galilee, they were the ones who had followed him and ministered to him. And there were also many other women who came up with him to Jerusalem. We'll read just that far. That's such a helpful idea to kind of wrestle with some of the characters in the story. And you'll probably find yourself reflected in a whole bunch of them. At points, you may be like Pilate, kind of judging Jesus, kind of wondering why he does what he does. At other points, you may simply be bowed down in worship, as some of those women would have been. Maybe you kind of feel that part of your life, you were one of the bystanders walking past, mocking Jesus. Every one of us is in one of these spaces today. And I imagine that when the dust had settled after the ascension of Jesus a few days later, and once sort of everybody had got back to their normal lives, there must have been a ton of discussions, sort of, you know, over meals like we would after some great event. There would be kind of been unpacking. What did you see and what did you hear and what did you experience at that time? And the four gospel writers, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, must have gone around and spoken to a bunch of these witnesses to kind of pack the story together. These were different men's accounts, but they also went out and spoke to others. You know, "I was standing on that side of the cross, and what did you see when you were over there in that corner? Because I saw something happened over there, but I kind of missed it." And they then packed together these stories and put them down in text for us to be able to reflect for centuries to come on what happened on that last few hours of Jesus' life. So one of the characters that I want to draw out of the story today was this Roman centurion who forever shall remain without name. And maybe one day when we get to heaven, we get to stand alongside him. Maybe then we can kind of introduce ourselves, find out who he was and what his life was like. But he had risen up through the ranks within the Roman army. He'd probably been in the army all his adult life, from probably 16, maybe even 15 years old. He would have been taught and trained to fight hand-to-hand combat. He was a man who was used to the rigors of war. He'd started off as a soldier in time, obviously having seen some battles and becoming battle-hardened. He then became what they called a veteran soldier, then a Roman standard, having shown off some leadership ability and his ability to manage men. He'd then become something called an immune, and then finally a Roman centurion, a man in charge of 100 soldiers. Sorry, we're going to close some of those doors. I'm watching some of you getting blown away. I have no idea what was going through his mind, but if he was like most of us, He probably had in mind this kind of progression, you know, the kind of corporate ladder. This was the corporate ladder of his day, and perhaps in time, maybe he hoped to become a Roman general. He was well accustomed to the sight of blood. Hand-to-hand combat was the order of the day. There was nothing like a clinical drone strike from several kilometers away where you sit in a control room and simply guide this vehicle to wherever it needs to be. But combat was hand-to-hand. It was bloody. And he was used to seeing the inside parts of people on the outside of their bodies. He was used to the blood and the guts and the smell of battle. He would have been used to the groans and the cries of those left to die on the battlefield. War in those days was truly brutal. And so as he watched Jesus hanging on the cross, as he was part of the flogging and the crucifixion, there was probably nothing that really kind of challenged him in this. This was regular stuff. This was kind of 9 to 5, you know. This is what he gets paid to do. This is his job. He has a list, a checklist every day of a bunch of prisoners, and his job is to flog them, beat them, and then hang them on a cross to die. As a Roman centurion in this outpost of the Roman Empire, this was probably a regular occurrence, putting to death Jewish rabble-rousers, people who would raise the people up against the Roman army. The Romans loved control, and they crushed with absolute power anything that rose up and tried to put Rome away. And they loved justice, but not like we would love it. No quick blow to the head, no quick beheading. No, they relished the torture and the punishment of putting people to death. And so they invented the most appalling ways to do so, and they thrived in it. This Roman centurion and his men were probably laughing as they beat people, as they flogged them, and then as they mocked them. There was a kind of a joyousness in it. I guess they were kind of giving it their best shot, doing their job to the best of their abilities. And because these men were prisoners, and because they had no right within the Roman Empire, they could do anything they wanted. It's often been said that the measure of a nation or a measure of a civilization is the way they treat their animals and the way they treat their prisoners. And the Romans had no mercy whatsoever. We're told by historical writers of the time that the Romans took great pleasure in inflicting huge amounts of pain and damage during the floggings. In fact, one of the historians, Eusebius, writes about these whips that they used to whip Jesus with, and he says that the whips had hooks embedded in, steel hooks that they'd manufactured, and often the veins and the muscles and even the entrails of the people that they flogged were laid bare. These men loved inflicting long and painful deaths, and so they put together this idea of a crucifixion, where a man would hang on the cross for hours and sometimes even 3 days before they would finally die. And this centurion was well versed in administering it all. He probably sat there with joy on his face watching this whole deal go down. And there was nothing particularly special about the prisoner for that day. In fact, it was probably a short day's work. 3 guys, we could get that done before 11 in the morning. It was simply another job to be done. And so, as he had done with countless other prisoners before, he beat Jesus, flogged him, mocked him, and then crucified him. He had no idea at all that he was fulfilling a series of ancient prophecies. King David, centuries before, had penned Psalm 22 under the inspiration of the Spirit, and this is what he wrote. See how much of this you remember from the story of Jesus' crucifixion. David writes this, my God, why have you forsaken me? Why are you so far from saving me? From the words of my groaning, I cry to you, my God, by day, but you do not answer, and by night, but I find no rest. Yet you, O Lord, are holy and enthroned on the praises of Israel. In you our fathers trusted. They trusted and you delivered them. To you they cried and they were rescued. In you they trusted and they were not put to shame. But I am a worm and not a man. I am scorned by mankind and am despised by the people. All who see me mock me. They make mouths at me. They wag their heads. He trusts in the Lord. Let him deliver him. Let him rescue him, for him he delights in him. And I'm poured out like water. My bones are out of joint. My heart is like wax. It's melted within my chest. My strength is dried up like a potsherd, and my tongue sticks to the roof of my mouth. You lay me in the dust of death, and the dogs surround me. A company of evildoers encircles me. They have pierced my hands and my feet. I can count my bones, and they stare and they gloat over me. And they divide my garments amongst them, and for my clothing they have cast lots. He had no idea that this ordinary Jewish prisoner, just another job to be ticked off for the day before he could go home and have lunch, was part of this grand story that God had been writing since the beginning of time. Hundreds of years before this centurion got to this moment, these prophecies had been spoken out, and as he murders Jesus, he is fulfilling those prophecies. The centurion and his men laughed at Jesus. They ridiculed him. They put on a crown of thorns on Jesus' head. Not a particularly painful thing, by the way. We don't have a lot of nerve endings on the top of our head, but there are a lot of blood vessels. And then they hit it in with a stick, because you don't want to get your hands all bloodied. And so they beat Jesus and beat the crown into his head. And so the blood must have run into his eyes and filling his ears until he could almost not hear and see at all. And they laughed and mocked him. They put a robe on him, a stick in his hand, because, well, hey, every good king has got to have a scepter. And they bowed down in fake worship. And then they spat on him. I guess the centurion was making the best of a slow day at the office. Just three guys to get done before lunch. And so he did his job well. The centurion had no idea to whom he was doing these things. He had no idea of Jewish understanding, no idea of Jewish religion, probably never picked up a Bible in his life. He worshipped a whole bunch of gods. There were all sorts of Roman gods that they worshipped. No idea that there was one single deity. He didn't have any idea about a coming Messiah or about a chosen one sent of God to save his people. Jesus was nothing more to him than another Jewish rebel whom he had been instructed by order of Pilate to put to death. And bar the sign that he put above Jesus' head that Pilate set him to put there, the King of the Jews, the scene was, I guess in a really macabre kind of way, really ordinary. There was nothing extraordinary about this. The people of Jerusalem would have walked past that place day after day, another body hanging on a cross, another person who annoyed the Romans, just another death. And then as Jesus breathes his last, Mark says that something happens in this man's life. In something about the way Jesus dies in his last breath, this Roman centurion standing there before Jesus, probably with a smile on his face watching Jesus die, almost home time now, he thinks. Something clicks and he says, truly this man was the Son of God. This guy is as far as you can get from the Christian faith culturally, far from the Jewish faith culturally. He is far from faith religiously. He has no understanding of theology from a biblical point of view. He is not a holy man in any definition of what it might mean to be a holy man. He is a brute in every way. And yet something in this man's mind clicks in this moment, and he recognizes Jesus for who he is. Something shifts deeply, not just in his mind, but in his heart, and he suddenly finds himself worshiping the Son of God. So I was kind of wrestling with this week, and I was wondering, what was it about the way that Jesus died that got this man's mind to shift? What was it that he saw in that moment? What was it that got him to move away from everything that he had held dear and everything that his culture held dear to turn and finally acknowledge that there was one God and that this Son of God was here dying on the cross? And that he, what kind of made him make that giant leap of faith? Was it the mercy that Jesus showed to the prisoner next to him? Because if you remember, these two prisoners are kind of at each other's throats. It's a bit like hungry dogs. When you've got a couple of dogs in a cage that are really hungry, they just eat each other. And so prisoners on the cross would have often reviled each other. You know, no, like, kind of, we're going to be in heaven. More like, yeah, I'll see you in hell kind of story. And Jesus turns to the one and says, today you will be with me in paradise. Was it that that kind of triggered this Roman centurion? Because he was used to people cursing and crying out and abusing the people that walked past. Was it that that got him to shift his thinking? Was it maybe the certainty, I wonder, about how Jesus called God Father? That would have been a very strange thing. Even for Jewish people, that was a kind of a weird thing. For a Roman guy to hear somebody talk to, first of all, a single God, but to talk to him in that kind of intimate, connected way, that must have shaken something in his understanding. And was it that, maybe, that got him to finally click that maybe this was who Jesus was, that he was really the Son of God? Maybe he had heard something of what the Jews had been saying at that time, that there was this coming Messiah. And in the way that Jesus cries out to God, in the way that he says, my God, why have you forsaken me? Was there something in that? Was there something in the passion and the intimacy with which Jesus spoke to the Father that triggered it? I don't know. Or was it maybe the forgiveness that Jesus offered to the centurion and his men? I would imagine that most people hanging on the cross are not overly keen on blessing the people that have been crucifying them. In fact, the Roman centurion is probably used to these guys calling down all the wrath of heaven. You know, curse these men, strike them down, Lord, I'm an innocent man, and just heaping abuse and curses. But Luke records it like this. When they came to the place called the skull and they crucified Jesus and the two criminals, one on his right and the other on his left, Jesus said, "Father, forgive them, for they don't know what they're doing." Was there something about Jesus crying out to God and asking for mercy and blessing instead of cursing and destruction that got the centurion to finally shift his mind about who Jesus was? Whatever it was in Jesus' death, something moves this man to a place of worship. Now here's where the centurion's mind must have gone just totally fractured. So here he is. Okay, it's kind of Monday morning, you know, just a normal day in the office, got the checklist, got a whole bunch of tasks my boss has given me to do. I'm trying to crack them off as quickly as I can, because the quicker I can get the tasks done, the quicker I can get home. And you would kind of hope that these guys would die quickly, because the quicker they died, the sooner your day was done. And there's just another name and another name and another name, and they're meaningless people, and you don't care about their families or about their futures or about their past. All you want to do is do your job and get it done fast. And then in this moment, as this prisoner dies, which you've watched 1,000 times before, this is nothing new for you, nothing extraordinary, then you suddenly realize that you are the man who has killed the Son of God. Like, how do you stand at that point? How do you not run and hang yourself like Judas did? How do you not get so caught up in despair and hopelessness? This has got to be some weighty stuff on your shoulders. I believe this whole story is evidence that us being saved is up to God and not up to us. So we preach every Sunday, and we preach the gospel, I believe, faithfully in this church. We try and take the scriptures and draw meaning out of the scriptures, not just our opinions, but we want to hear God's opinion of our lives. And I think week after week, I'm going to do it a little bit later, I'm going to ask you to make a commitment to Jesus. But what the story of the centurion tells us, that to move people from outside of the faith into genuine faith, it has to be a work of the Spirit. It has to be something God does in shifting the heart. It's not just like an intellectual decision. It's got to be something deeper. It's got to be something much more powerful. So at one point, Jesus says to his friends, he says to them, "Who do you say that I am?" Because people were saying all sorts of things about who Jesus was. So he says to the guys, who do you think I am? And Simon Peter, because Simon's always the first one with an answer. You know when you're in a meeting and the boss sort of says, "Hey guys, what do you think about this idea?" There's always that guy. You know the one I'm talking about. He's always got his hand in the air, always got the answer. And it's normally the stupid answer and the wrong answer. But he doesn't realize this. Low EQ kind of guys. This is Peter. But Peter in this moment, with absolute clarity, says this. "You are the Christ, the Son of the living God." And listen to what Jesus says to him. "Blessed are you, Simon Bar-Jonah, for flesh and blood has not revealed this to you." This isn't like your brain has made this jump on its own. This isn't like you've thought through a nice, clean, rational argument and gone, you know, that and that and that and that. When I add all of those up, therefore Jesus is the Son of God. He says this, "No, my Father who is in heaven has revealed this to you." Being saved by Jesus is always a work of God, not a work of the flesh. We give testimony. I hope you're doing this. I hope you're spending time talking to your friends about Jesus and about his life, death, resurrection. I hope you talk about how Jesus has flipped, turned your life upside down, shaken your world, transformed your life. We tell our stories, but it has to be a work of the Spirit that gets people to convert their faith. And that is what happens in the centurion. It can only have been. I mean, I can't imagine somebody a lot further from Christian faith than that. I mean, here is a guy who's got blood in his hands. That's his job. He has a long history of murdering God's people. He's a thuggish brute in every way, religiously uneducated, and yet God saves him. Much more than a mind game. Much more than a logical conversion. It's a deep heart moment. So in a couple of hours' time, I climb on a plane with a bunch of people from this church. We're flying halfway around the world to the Middle East to go spend some time with a bunch of Syrian refugees who have escaped the war in Syria and are now living in Jordan, some of them in refugee camps, a lot of them living in a little town called Mufraq. And we're going to be spending time in their homes, and we're hoping to convince them, by God's grace, that Jesus really is who Jesus said he was. But you see, for them, the idea that God has a son is blasphemous. Because their thinking is straight away, well, then God must have had sexual intercourse with a woman, and that just doesn't work in their minds. And that's not what the church has ever said, but that's their immediate leap. And we are convinced that whilst we will tell our stories, our own personal stories about what Jesus has done for us, we have to have a great work of the Holy Spirit to get them from where they are into faith. But the story of the centurion reminds us that there is no barrier to God's work. The fact that this man finds hope, finds faith, finds forgiveness from Jesus, is a story of hope for us all. One of the beautiful things about pastoral ministry is we get to have you open your lives up to us. We just spend time with people in the life of the church, and they begin to share. You begin to share something of yourself with us. Now, a lot of you have done some pretty rotten stuff. I know a lot of bad stories. You know, I'm really glad that we don't know each other's stories fully, because I think we'd be horrified. But I have yet to meet somebody in this church or in any of the churches that I have served who has a story as bad as this Roman centurion's. I mean, this is a dark heart, a dark past, a long history of war and violence and bloodshed. This man is as far as we could find someone from Jesus. And yet God doesn't seem to be scared by the mess of his life. Jesus isn't nervous about getting involved, not ashamed in any way. And the Holy Spirit is able to take the centurion's dark and destructive heart that is bent on evil and shine into it what a later writer in the Bible would call the light of the knowledge of the glory of God in the face of Jesus. You can go and reflect on that when you get home. Most of you, I have no idea what that means. I don't either. But there is something of a light in Jesus that shines its way into dark hearts. And it seems so clear from the centurion's story that there is nothing that would stop the grace of Jesus touching someone's life. There is no past bad enough that Jesus is not willing to get involved. There is no mindset. Paul writes it like this at one point. He speaks about these men's minds having been literally scarred. Their consciences have been seared with a hot iron. And if you've ever burnt yourself really badly, you know the feeling never really comes back to that space. The skin has always kind of got this dullness to it. Somehow the Spirit is able to take that scarring and undo it and allow us to see and to worship and praise. This is the good news of the crucifixion. This is the good news of the resurrection. That a way has been opened for everyone and anyone to enter into the grace and mercy that Jesus offers. Listen carefully here. I don't know how much you talk about the cross when you talk about Jesus, but you have to talk about the cross because you cannot separate Jesus from the cross. Crossless Christianity is not Christianity at all, because at the cross, that's where death was dealt its final blow. It's only at the cross that you can meet Jesus. It's only at the cross when, like the centurion, and you're watching Jesus' death, when you see his death, it's at that point that you can finally say, that's the Son of God. Anything else you have, any idea of God outside of the cross of Jesus, is not the Christian faith. It's meaningless. Here's how important it is. God does some pretty amazing things in the scriptures, okay? So he causes the blind people to see. He gives hearing again to those that are deaf. He takes people that have got shriveled hands, speaks a word of healing. Their hands are made whole. You know the deal. I mean, you've seen all of this. Jesus raises dead people. He heals the sick. Jesus does a lot of miraculous things. So one of the things that God does in this whole Easter event, Jesus dies on the cross, nails through the hands and through the feet, spear in the side. Jesus dies, buried. Third day, God raises Jesus from the dead. That's pretty miraculous. So if Jesus can be raised from the dead by the power of God, I am sure that healing a couple of scars is not a difficult job. And yet God does not heal the scars. For all eternity in his resurrection body, Jesus carries the wounds in his hand and the spear wound in his side. You remember doubting Thomas, you remember? And he sticks his... I just kind of wonder how he did it. Did he do it kind of gently, or did he just like really stick his fingers in? Like, I want to see, is this real? You cannot talk about Jesus without talking about the crucified God. That is who he is. He was called, Revelation 13, he was called the Lamb who was slain since before the foundations of the earth. Jesus cannot be separated from the cross. He is the man upon the cross. And I don't know what the centurion saw. One day when I get to heaven, I'm going to ask him, but what was it? But he saw something in Jesus' death that moved him to a place of faith. So please don't run too quickly to Sunday. Sunday's a day of celebration. So would you all wear white, please? Okay? Men, no white pants. It's the only caveat I have. Okay? White pants, not good on guys. Ladies, you look wonderful in white pants. Men, not so much. But wear white to celebrate the fact that Jesus is alive. We want to celebrate resurrection. But don't run there too fast. Because it seems that the way people recognize that Jesus is who Jesus says he was is on the Friday. The resurrection, you can't separate the resurrection from the crucifixion. But don't run too fast and too far from the pain of the cross. Because it's there that the eyes of faith are opened. It's there that we meet the suffering and crucified God. And it is there at the cross, as we face the cross, maybe with mocking and ridicule, with laughter, with no sense of the holiness of what happened in that moment. But it's there when the centurion sees that this is how Jesus died. It's there that he finds faith and his life is forever transformed. The Bible never tells us much about him. But I can imagine him sitting at a dinner table across from Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. And they say to him, "Tell us your story." And then he simply tells the story of how it was another day at the office. And then in that moment, his life was changed forever. And he finally saw the truth he'd been longing for all his life. Let's pray.